And I'd like to introduce Rasheed S. from Midtown.
Yeah. My name is Rasheed. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
Thank you for having me out. It was a nice ride down. Got to hang out with one of my brothers, Jeff, and we came down and ate some good old Subway, you know. But I've come down here before, and it's nice to get out and be invited and be welcome in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's an honor and a privilege to be able to come and speak and share my experience, strength, and hope. Honestly, my sobriety date is August the 2nd, 2004. Midtown is my home group. I do have a sponsor. His name is Mike H. He's at my home group tonight, which they're having an anniversary dinner that I'm missing, which is all good. You know, it's all good. But that sponsor knows he's my sponsor today. And, you know, those couple of things were not even on the radar when I got sober. Having a sponsor, a home group, sobriety day, that was far from what was on the menu with me. So I'll share with you guys in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in DC. I grew up in a family of seven. I'm the middle of seven kids. I grew up in an environment where drinking was normal. Everybody drank in my family. I mean, you know, I remember the family going to get crabs, and you know, we would go down southwest to the wharf and get crabs and bring them back home. And the family would put the Budweiser in the crabs with the Old Bay. And I just remember everybody drinking, and it was a normal thing growing up to see people drinking alcohol, you know. moving forward, and I'll just share this because it's just a part of my story. It doesn't make me alcoholic, but it is a part of my story. My household, it was a lot of craziness going on. A lot of abuse going on, a lot of physical abuse, mental abuse. It was all kind of stuff going on in my household growing up. So I just feel like by the time I took that first drink, I probably needed it well before that time, you know? And so pretty much I was a late starter in drinking. I was kind of scared to drink, but I do remember seeing drinking and seeing it. You know, drinking was a normal thing. But I remember seeing my uncle James. He used to drink Thunderbird. And he would fill up a empty trash can of Thunderbird. By the end of the week, it would be filled with empty bottles of Thunderbird. And I remember one time I was hanging out with my friends, and I came up the back of the house, and I seen him like puking up blood. It was just like, it was keep coming up. And I was like, man, you know, I'm never going to drink. I just associated that with him drinking all of that Thunderbird. And so moving forward, I was a little skinny, scrawny kid growing up. I wasn't no tough guy. I wasn't none of those things that I wanted to be, you know. And so I hung out with older guys in my neighborhood. All of my friends growing up were at least 3-4 years older than me, you know. And so for me growing up in the city, like, not being that tough guy and ready to fight, you had to be doing something to fit in to be allowed to hang with these guys. And so for me, before I even took a drink, and drugs are part of my story, and I'll just share them briefly, but because this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I started doing other, you know, I started, you know, dabbing the weed and sherm. Back in the days, you call it sherm sticks when I was growing up. And the only person that did the sherm sticks were drunks on the corner, you know. And so when my friends were drinking, because I was kind of scared to drink, I started smoking weed and doing that. And they thought I was crazy for doing that, you know. And that allowed me to kind of fit in and you know, and get by for a little bit until it came a point in time where I had to drink, you know. It was like, oh, man, you scared. And, you know, once you got 4 or 5 of your friends that you're trying to impress, you know, telling you that you're scared, and once they start calling me out of my name, it was a done deal, you know. And so I took that first drink of alcohol with some liquor. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I know I was scared to death because I just knew, you know, something bad was going to happen. You know, after seeing my uncle throw up blood like that, because that's the only thing I had in my mind to associate with drinking, was seeing my uncle kind of throw up that blood. And I took that shot of alcohol, man, and it went down hot. And then next thing you know, everything kind of warmed up inside, and it was like, boom, you know? And I pretty much, I drank alcoholically from that first drink. And I started drinking when I was at the ripe age of about 11 years old. I was one of those kids that ran away from home all the time. I ran the streets. My mom, you know, raising seven kids by herself, she was always at work till 8, 9 o'clock at night. And so I started drinking alcoholically right away. I had, like I said, I had a bunch of friends that were a little bit older than me. And so we lived in DC, you know, living in DC, any city, I mean, you can get your hands on whatever you want. Doesn't matter how old you are. You know, you got some change to give to a bum. You can go get, you know, whatever kind of liquor you want and whatever else, you know. And so that's what we did, man. We had no trouble getting alcohol, you know, and all the guys in my neighborhood that were the drug dealers and had the nice cars and this, that, and the other, they would happily give us, you know, what we wanted if we were out there hanging with them. So I, you know, like I said, I drank alcoholically from the jump. And what happened pretty much was that I had an older brother. He would go back and forth to jails, and then it eventually, you know, evolved into him going to prisons. And I just remember him being gone for brief, you know, months and years at a time, and then it would suddenly come back. And I think what happened was my mom didn't want that to happen for me. I think she kind of saw the direction I was going. So we end up moving out of DC. We moved to Maryland. And I don't know about y'all, but I'm from the city. Moving from the city to the suburbs was like moving to a whole nother planet, you know, because I couldn't go walk straight down the street to go get somebody to give me liquor. I couldn't go see my, you know, like I needed a car to go. And my mom didn't have a car, you know. And so when we moved to Maryland, my drinking kind of slowed down. Not because I wanted it to, is because that's just what the situation was. I couldn't get it like I could when I lived in D.C. And when I would go up to the little Robbins drugstore that sold liquor and stand out in front of the store and try to get people to go and buy it, they would look at me like I was crazy. And I was just like, what's going on? You know, why don't you guys just go get me some liquor? You know, they were like, no, we can go to jail for this, you know, and I just didn't understand it, you know. And so I would drink when I could, and I would scrounge up enough change for moms to get on the bus to go ride down to DC and get to DC and get loaded like I wanted to, you know. And I did that for as long as I could. Eventually, you know, like I said, once I moved to Maryland, I started high school in Maryland, and I never went. I was so used to going, even in middle school. I remember going to middle school, leaving middle school, going to get drunk and coming back to middle school. Now, I have a 12-year-old son right now that's in middle school. I can't even imagine, you know, this dude going out, get drunk and come back, you know. And so that's kind of how my drinking was. I drink alcoholically from the jump, but I started high school in Maryland, and I never went. And when you don't go to high school in Montgomery County, where I live, that they actually send a truant officer, or they'll have somebody come out to the house. And so what they did was they told my mom that, like, if I didn't go to school, it was a possibility she could go to jail. You know, and so I heard that. And the only thing I heard was that the only person that was giving me money to go get drunk and do whatever else was mom. So I got to go to school, you know. And so I started going to school, and eventually I ended up getting on the football team my junior year. And I got on the football team. And mind you this, throughout my drinking, like, my mom was in AA for a period of time when I was younger, too. And she used to take me to all the AA dances, and I would be that kid going in the dance and break dancing and doing all, you know, and having it over the folk. They're like, yeah, he's so cute, you know. And I remember hearing, you know, at the end of the meetings, it works if you work it, right? I remember hearing that. And I remember also hearing my mom, through my, you know, my alcoholism, tell me that I needed NA or AA. And I would tell her, I don't need that shit, you know? And so and so that's kind of how it was. So I got on this football team, and I kind of stopped doing what I was doing for a period, you know? Like, I stopped drinking. I was on the football team, and I wanted to try to, you know, be good and, you know, be this good player. And so when the football season was going on and 2-a-days, I stopped drinking for a minute. But I'm going to tell you what, as soon as football was over, I was right back to it like I never even left it, you know? And that's kind of how it went. And so by my senior year in high school, here it was, it was flag football time, because what they would do now, they started this flag football before we started the 2-a-days. So I got into the flag football for the football team. And I'm one of those kids, I went to all the schools, summer school, night school, day school, any school that you can think of, I've done it. And so here it was my senior year, I needed to go to summer school because I needed credits that I didn't get. And I was catching the bus to summer school, and I come out the house and I see one of my neighbor's car is running. It's one of those cold mornings, you know? And I'm like, man, if I can get up here to the bus stop and this bus drives by and I miss it, I'm going to steal my neighbor's car. And you know what the rest of the story is like. I get up the street, I see the bus go by, and I go back down to my neighbor's, you know, and take their car, you know? By the end of the night, I'm in DC, I'm loaded like I want to be. I'm drunk out of my mind. One of my good friends, he done bust the back window out of the car, you know? I put a trash bag on the back of the window because, you know, it's not a big deal, right? You know? And I drive that car home like it was mine. Drive that car home, go to sleep, wake up the next morning and drive that car, or attempted to drive that car right to football practice, right? But, you know, Montgomery County Police don't like it when you drive other people's cars. And they pulled me over. And that was kind of my first encounter with the police in the state of Maryland. And I went down to the police station, and it wasn't no real consequences. They told my mom that, you know, I would have to pay some fines and so on and so forth. And so kind of that was that. But that kind of started the process for me, because what happened was after I got out of high school, I was one of those guys, I can go get a job wherever, you know, and be good and have people like me for about 2 months. And then I stopped showing up, you know. And then it's like, you know what, man, we love you, man, but we just can't do this, you know. And so that's kind of where things went to after I got out of high school. And then I still had that thing where I wanted to fit in. You know, I wanted people. I was hanging out with guys that was shooting people, stabbing people, robbing people. I was robbing people. You know, I just wanted people to have this persona of me because that's just what I grew up in. And when you live like that and you do the things that we do to get drunk and loaded, then you end up going to jail sometimes. You know, that's not a requirement to be an alcoholic, but that's just my story. And so I started going to jail, you know, and when you start going to jail, the time doesn't get shorter and shorter. It just increases every time you go back. And so that's kind of what happened with me. You know, 1 month would turn into the next time 3 months, and then 6 months, and then 9 months. And then next thing you know, I'm spending, you know, years of my life in and out of jail, you know. And so that's kind of how it went for a while in the middle of my alcoholism, because I didn't know I was alcoholic, you know. I had been sent to classes and so on and so forth throughout my drinking by judges and all of this stuff, but that didn't matter. It wasn't nothing going to stop me from drinking the way that I was drinking besides the way that I got sober, you know? And so what happened, I was in Pennsylvania. I was living up in Pennsylvania, and I got locked up in Pennsylvania. And I had like a pound of weed or something. And where I was living out of Pennsylvania, a pound of weed is like having like a truckload of weed, you know? And so I went to court and, you know, I got sentenced to 6 months, but, you know, I'm one of those good alcoholics. I go to jail and I start meeting people just like me, you know? And 6 months turned to 9 months, and then 9 months turned into a year, you know? And then I would do what I always do when I go to jail. I go to jail and I make these resolutions. I'm not going to hang out with them. I'm not going to, you know, if I stop doing this, it never worked for me, you know? And so I got out, they let me out on the side of a country road up in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. And my cousin came to pick me up, and he had just bought this brand new Crown Victoria police package. And pretty, man, pretty, oh my God. And he asked me, he said, where you want to go, man? You want to go to your step-parents' house, or you want to go to your mom's house? Now, my step-parents are some good friends of the family that took me in and allowed me to stay with them in Pennsylvania until I end up getting my own place, right? And my mom is, you know, my blood mom, my mom, the person that was only sending me money, you know, sending my crusty butt any kind of money, any kind of letters, you know, because none of my homeboys that I hung out with, they didn't come see me and they ain't send me no letters or no money. And so my intentions were good. You know, I wanted to go see my mom's, you know, and mind you, my mom's is down in my old neighborhood in Maryland, you know. And I said, let's go see my mom's. I go down to the neighborhood. And as soon as I get to the neighborhood, it's one of those communities where it's one way in and one way out, and it's all gated. I get in the community and I start yelling out here, yelling out there. And the next thing you know, some of my homeboys come out that house, some other people come out this house, and then some other people come out. And the next thing you know, we got a 15 pack of Blue Bull. We got a 15 pack of Red Bull. My cousin knows where the liquor store is on Sunday. And like nothing ever happened, man. I'm off to the races, you know. By the end of that night, I didn't talk my cousin into letting me drive his brand new Crown Victoria. And so what happened was I was in the brownout. And I was in and out of the night, you know, and I was in and out when I was driving this car. And so I end up hitting about 6 or 7 parked cars. And so what I remember is coming to and the airbags going off after we crashed and then somebody laughing in the car. And then I get out of the car because I'm in like, you know, fight or flight mode at this point. I'm going to jail, you know? And so I get out of the car. Mind you, I got one of my good friends in the car, my cousin. Well, two of my good friends are in the car, my cousin and my stepsister in the car. And I'm getting out the car with one of these friends ready to run and leave the scene because forget any of them, you know, I got to get out of here. And so after that, I don't remember anything. Everything else is from the police report. They said I left the scene. I came back to the scene of the accident. The police officer was talking to me. I projectile vomited at the police officer. I fell flat on my face. And the next thing I remember is waking up in Suburban Hospital down in Bethesda, Maryland, with IV in my arm. I got the gown on. I got the black charcoal all down in front of me because I had alcohol poisoning. And I got the keys to the car in my hand. And so I wake up, I look at these bright lights like we got here. And I'm thinking I'm in jail because literally this hasn't even been 24 hours of me just doing a year in jail. And this is where my alcoholism takes me to. And so I look up and I don't know, I can't remember what happened. And so I see I got the keys in my hand and I'm thinking, honestly, I'm hoping I didn't kill anybody because I just can't remember a damn thing, you know? And so I asked the nurse, I said, hey, what happened last night? She said, man, you don't remember what happened? I said, no, what happened? She said, well, you were in a real bad car accident and you crashed. I said, was anybody hurt? And she said, no, everybody was fine. And that was probably one of the biggest reliefs that I had is to know that I didn't kill anybody that night, you know. And next thing you know, the phone in the hospital rang randomly, and it's my stepbrother, and he's like, hey, we're coming to break you out. And for a brief moment I'm thinking that's probably not a good idea, and then the next thought, come on, you know. And next thing you know, my stepbrother and 3 or 4 of my new best friends are trying to break me out of Suburban Hospital. I'm on the third floor. By the time they get up there, we're fighting with the doctors. We got the security up there. It's just a freaking mess, you know? You know, we're fighting. We're trying to get out. Next thing you know, I'm naked. I'm trying to pull a catheter out. I don't know if you ever had a catheter in, but that didn't work, you know? So it's just a mess. It's just a mess. You know, I tell my brother and his friend, I said, just leave. Because I know I'm going back to jail at this point, you know? So they leave the hospital. And Montgomery County Police came to the hospital. It was probably like 25 officers to come up there. And I already know I'm going back to jail. And they said, Mr. Shabazz, we don't have any reports of any accident you were in the night before or anything. And for an alcoholic of my type, that's like the best news smoking, you know? And so I was like, great, you know? And at the time, the hospital I was in, they would give you these tokens to get a cab ride free if you didn't have a way to get home. And I got a cab ride back to my drinking location, you know? And by that end of that night, I was high and drunk, you know, like I wanted to be, you know? Within the next 2.5, 3 weeks tops, Montgomery County Police had a warrant out for my arrest, you know? Because like I told you guys, I do whatever it is I got to do to get drunk and loaded like I want to. And I had a good friend, a young guy. He would go and burglarize these houses. And he would come to me with the stolen goods. Now, I was already known for taking stolen goods to the pawn shop. And so if this guy was going to go steal the stuff and bring it to me and split the money with me, that was great. That was just like a business opportunity for me. And so that's what I did. Well, I was taking stuff from him and take it to the pawn shop and pawn it. And this one time, here it is. I'm up to the pawn shop, got this brand new saxophone that I'm taking into the pawn shop. And they say, Mr. Shabazz, Montgomery County Police have a hold on your account. And I already knew what that meant, that they're looking for me again, you know? And so I tried to run up to Pennsylvania where I just did that 12 months at, ran up there and tried to hide out, and Montgomery County ran right behind me, you know? And the next thing you know, I was locked up in that same jail I just got out of a year ago. And everybody in there is like, man, what the, you know? So they extradited me down to Montgomery County, and I was looking at 6 years in prison. They suspended everything except for 18 months. So I ended up doing a year in the Clarksburg jail. And then I got out and they released me into this work release center, like a halfway house type deal. So I got to the work release and they said, Mr. Shabazz, you got to go to one NA or AA meeting a week. I said, I don't need any of that shit, you know? And they said, well, if you don't go to one NA or AA meeting a week, you're going back to jail. And I was like, where's the meeting? At that point, I had been, my butt had been whooped. I was done. I was just in a spot where I was so done. Like I said, I've been to jail 15, 20 times, you know? And any time I had to go, I got a letter to go to court. I never went to court. You had to come get me, you know? And so I was tired. And so I started going to the meetings that they were bringing into the work release center. And I started there. And then I got introduced to a young people's group outside of the pre-release center. And the only reason I went is because this guy that I had met, he had just come down from doing like 10 years in the federal penitentiary, you know, because always I got to meet the, you know, the people like me, you know. And so this guy says, man, I know this meeting. It's a bunch of girls there, man. I bet you can't get one girl's number. I bet you a steak dinner. Let's go. Where's the meeting? And that's how I found, you know, my home group. So I go to this meeting. It's a bunch of young people there. It's a bunch of people my age there. And everybody is looking so damn happy. And I'm like, I just need to find out who's getting drunk and who's getting high. And then I'll be happy too, you know? Because I just knew it was no way that everybody was sober. I just knew it, you know? And so people did what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. They asked me if I had a sobriety date, a home group, a sponsor. And I could have, like I said, I could have cared less about any of that. I just didn't want to go back to jail, you know? And so after the meeting, I ran out quick. And it was a guy outside already. He had on a suit and he asked me what people had been asking me before the meeting. You got a sponsor, a home group. And I was so sick and tired of people asking me. I said, man, look, you can be my sponsor, man. So that's kind of how the journey started for me, man. This guy put me in his back pocket, man. And he did what we do here, man. He introduced me to his friends. And then his friends introduced me to their friends. And the next thing you know, I was in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't even know. I had no clue. And he told me, he said, Rashid, I can't tell you if you're alcoholic or not. That's going to be something you're going to have to figure out for yourself. And the best way to figure that out is to go to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So you can hear a lot of different people share their experience, strength, and hope. He said, so that's going to be your deal. You're going to have to come to that understanding. And that's what he did. And he also told me that he wanted me to call a couple people a day, call three guys a day. And I didn't understand why the hell he wanted me to call three guys a day. I was like, I just came from jail. I'm not trying to call three guys, you know. But, you know, like I said, I was desperate. So I tried to the best of my ability to do what he asked me to do. I would call these guys. People would come pick me up and buy me dinner and all that. And where I come from, when people did something nice for you, just look out, you know, because I just wasn't used to that. And so having people pick me up, take me to dinner, and like actually care about me, I didn't understand why they cared so much about me being sober. I just didn't understand that. And And so I just kept doing the things he suggested for me to do. My sponsor would come also to pick me up and take me to dinner. We would sit and read that big book together. He would read it with me because I'm one of those guys, I don't read until I'm in a, you get me locked up, I'm reading anything I can read, you know? And so, you know, having him sit down and read that big book with me to help me identify myself in that big book, especially in the doctor's opinion, man, that was powerful, you know? But just being able to see little points, and then he always had me read 60 to 64, man, 60 to 64. And so we would read that stuff, man. And I started to relate in, because I immediately related out. You know, the meetings I go to is a bunch of young people, but it wasn't a lot of Black folks in the meeting. And so I immediately started relating out. Oh man, they ain't from where I'm from, or this, that, and the other. But I'm gonna tell you what happened was I started to go to enough meetings where I started to hear people's stories. And the people, they looked good too. The people looked good and clean. So I just knew they couldn't be from where I was from or come from anything like that. And the more I was able to hear these people's stories, I was just blown away, because some people have stories worse than mine that I couldn't even fathom, you know? And that helped me, that gave me some hope that, you know what, maybe I'll be all right. Maybe I can stay here and I'll be all right, you know? And so we kept going through those steps. We got into that fourth and fifth step, and I was able to get some things down on paper. And that wasn't too difficult for me. I was so programmed into going to, so when I would go to jails, I would always end up in a program where I had to be in a class or do something, you know? And so when I got out and we started to work on that fourth step, it wasn't as hard as I seen some other people have a hard time with it, because I was able to just kind of write this stuff down and kind of go over it with them. And I almost looked at it like a homework assignment, you know, because I just didn't really understand what the magnitude of doing this fourth and fifth step would be, you know? And getting that stuff off my chest was like, I mean, it was like a weight off my back, you know? And then I also had a lot of people around me that were either doing their fourth and fifth step or not doing their fourth and fifth step and going to get drunk. And I'm not saying necessarily they went to get drunk because they didn't do it, but that's what I saw, you know? And so we got that done, and I felt like I was a part of what people were doing. I felt more a part of Alcoholics Anonymous after doing that fourth and fifth step, that's for sure. And, you know, and so, you know, we just started going on this journey, and it's kind of funny because that same sponsor that I got as my sponsor, he ended up leaving AA when I had about 9 months sober. And luckily enough, I ended up staying here and not following what he did, you know, and I got another sponsor immediately, and we started to kind of continue on with the steps. You know, he had me started to work on these amends right away. You know, he had me right away get that list together and start. And most of my amends were more family amends. I brought a lot of chaos to my mom's house when I was out there drinking. I was one of those guys that, you know, I would tell you I had a house where, my house is down the street, where it was like, no, I sleep in a sleeping bag 4 feet away from the front door, and all of my belongings are in the coat closet, you know? I mean, man, it's amazing. But we started to continue to go through, and man, I started getting that list together, and I started making amends immediate, pretty much to the family, like living the man, starting to show up for family, starting to do the things that I wasn't doing before I get sober. Like when Thanksgiving came around, people were talking about going to Thanksgiving and trying to bring something to the occasion versus take something, you know? And what that meant for me in early sobriety, and still can mean the same thing today, is to go and maybe just do the dishes, maybe just help out with something around the house, you know, and just make it not about me, you know? It can't be about me. And we started to do that kind of stuff. And the amends process has been a joy, because I had this girlfriend or ex-fiance that I wanted, you know, in my mind, I'm like, man, I want to go and make this right. My sponsor was like, nope, leave it alone. You know, leave it alone, you know? And another amends was to these guys that you know, I had this situation where I was in some, we were trying to rob these guys, and, you know, some of the guys got caught, and then they end up, you know, telling on us, and where I come from, you don't tell, you know? And so I guess the guy got word that I, you know, was going to do something to him. So I don't know if they moved out the country, what happened? And so my sponsor said, look, you need to write a letter. You know, he had me write a letter and kind of get that on paper and do that amends part that way versus trying to seek this guy out or anything like that. So, you know, it's been stuff like that. And then a bunch of money has been paid back. I mean, I stole from every daggone store I could steal from. 7-Eleven, little mom and pop shop, because I was stealing Mad Dog 2020 left and right. You know, if you had a Mad Dog 2020 in your store, I was going to steal it, you know. And so I started paying some of these amends back, these old doctor bills and phone bills, and start to try to right some of these wrongs. And, you know, and another one that was really, really hit me hard was, so my mom's ex-husband or late husband, when I was in the middle of my drinking, I remember being pissed off at him and thinking it was a great idea to just cut and slash all of his tires, you know? So I did that. And so when I got sober, my sponsor asked me, he said, look, you need to go to your mom and ask her how much money you owe her. And I was like, oh God, this ain't gonna go good. And so I went to my mom and did that, did what my sponsor told me to do. She said $700 and something. I was like, mom, are you sure? I don't think that's right. And she said, yeah, just $700 and something. So I went back to my sponsor. I said, my mom said, I only owe her $700 and something, right? He said, no, you need to go back to your mom and let her know that if you don't make these amends, that you're probably going to drink again, you know? And so I went back to my mom and honestly said, look, mom, like, I need to really make sure that, like, what, you know, what you need me to pay back is, you know? So she continued to say $700 and something. So I had a little side job that I did, and I gave her that money back, and come to find out that money was for the tires that I slashed on her husband's car, you know? And mind you, at this point, I've probably been sober almost 18 months, and he was there when I gave her that money. And I can see the total look on his face. It was totally different from what it was, you know, from before I got sober, you know? And that was a joy to be able to see that Alcoholics Anonymous was working in my life. And I was doing some things that were suggested to me, and other people can see that something was changing, you know? And I was glad I was able to do that before he passed away, because when he did pass away and I was at the funeral, I cried like a baby, you know? I didn't realize how much he had did for me until he was gone, you know? And so, that, you know, the amends process has been one of those things where it's definitely changed my sobriety for the better. And it's still more work to do for me, you know, it's still more work to do. And, you know, today things are totally different from what they were when I got sober. You know, like I said, I got out of the PRC, I got out of the work release. I got out of there, I had two Rubbermaid boxes in the trash bag. And so with that sponsor, that first sponsor I had, he told me to get into a sober house. So I did, I moved into a sober house. And he told me to go. It was this event coming up called the Men's Advance that we've been doing every year. And he said, man, go to the Men's Advance. Johnny H. is going to be there. And, you know, you should go. And mind you, I just got out of this work release center, and I had a little bit of money saved up, because they make you save money. They take a portion of your money and then they make you save money. So I had about almost $1,500 when I got out. And my sponsor was like, yeah, you should go. Like, oh no, but I end up going, and that changed the trajectory of my sobriety too. Just going there to hear Johnny Hurd speak, because when I got there, I was like, what is this old white guy gonna tell me? This guy's not gonna tell me nothing, you know? And he got up there and he shared his experience, strength, and hope, and it blew me away, you know? And so that was another, you know, moment in my sobriety where was something else to keep me here, kind of ground me in Alcoholics Anonymous, just another thing, another nugget, you know? And did that, and end up after the Men's Advance, I got into, so I was working for a company called, it's an electrical company called New Age Electric. I was working for this company and they were paying for my schooling, and I had to get people to come pick me up when they would have these events, these Christmas events, But I just didn't know how to live sober, you know? And so I allowed people, Alcoholics Anonymous, to show me what to do, you know? And so they would have these little parties. They would come pick me up. And I started the apprenticeship, you know, when I was there and started doing that. And every year I would think I was going to fail, you know, but I just kept doing what people suggested for me to do here, man. And I end up eventually getting off probation, and I was scared to death because I hadn't been off probation since I was 18 years old, you know, and got off probation. And I just gave it a long look, man. It was like, you know what? I haven't been to jail in 2 years. I might as well just stay here, you know? And I just stayed. I just stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and just kept doing the stuff that was taught to me. And, you know, eventually I didn't have a car for the first 2 years of my sobriety. And so I would get rides from everybody, which is a blessing and a curse, right? Because you're that new guy that calls people like, you know, half an hour before the meeting. Hey, man, can I get a ride? You know? And so I did a lot of that, you know, my first 2 years. And it was great because I got to experience a lot of those AA car rides, you know, like me and Jeff had coming down here, you know, where I've probably talked more than he did, you know? And, but that's just another great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that, you know, along with all those car rides are a lot of memories, a lot of sober memories, good sober memories, you know, to replace all those bad, you know, drunk memories, you know? And so, so it kind of got off probation, got through that. And it's kind of wild because I didn't have a car for 2 years, and all of a sudden I had a car that I bought from a friend in AA for $200. And then I got with this new company and gave me a work van, you know, and next thing you know, I have two cars, you know, and they let me drive the truck wherever I want. And it was like, what the, you know? So I just kept doing stuff here, man. I just continually keep doing stuff here. Keep getting my service positions, keep staying available, you know? And not every day is great. You know, I end up getting married and to this wonderful woman. I don't know why she married me, but it's all good, you know? So I get married and I get married to a woman that already had 5 kids, right? So we get married and we add one more. So now we have 6, right? And the week we got married, I got laid off from work.
Oh.
But being here, being a good member in Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing, people, you know, once they knew I didn't have work, man, they just started telling me, oh, we're going to, you know, they would tell me their aunt need work or this person. And the next thing you know, I was working, you know, and next thing you know, I'm working for myself, you know, and here it is, you know, almost 15 years later, you know. I've been working for myself. I'm a guy that barely got out of high school, you know, barely got out. They gave me my diploma. They didn't want me to come back, you know. And so that's just another, you know, blessing, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, because everything is good and decent in my life is definitely a direct result of AA, you know. I met my wife through a friend in AA, and it's just a blessing, man, and, you know, this has been a heck of a ride, man. It just has been, man. It's been so much that's gone on. So in my early sobriety, my oldest sister, she had shot somebody in the face and she was looking at life in prison. And then my little brother, he had stabbed himself in the heart with a steak knife. And they had a metal vacuum up to Baltimore. And then my niece, she had came down with this virus, which, you know, it was like all three of these things are happening within my first year of sobriety. And luckily enough, I was around people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was just so in the middle around people that people were able to kind of carry me through that. And so I just feel like a lot of, you know, turning it over and coming to believe, I mean, that was happening before my eyes, before I knew it. I mean, I know for me, when I think about like the, you know, the second step, and you know, I think about that insanity that precedes the first drink, you know, and coming to believe, you know, or something bigger than me. I mean, like, I mean, I don't know how I got through that other than like, that was definitely God doing something for me that I couldn't do for myself, you know, and being able to kind of go through some of that stuff and not get drunk or high. That's just like, that wasn't even on the map when I got here. I just wasn't even on the map. So, Alcoholics Anonymous works, you know, it just does, you know, but I just have to put in the work of certain things that I have to do here. And if I don't do them, you know, I'll get the results from not doing them, you know. And sometimes there's been times where I don't want to go to meeting, or I don't want to call somebody, or I don't, you know. And my sponsor would always tell me, I don't care how you feel. I just care what you do, you know. And that's been the thing here, man. It's like, I have to take action. I have to be willing on a daily basis to turn this thing over and continue to, I just want to stay here. You know, I want to stay here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And so for me to do that, I need to be willing to be honest with people. And I got to be willing to be vulnerable, you know? And sometimes I don't want to be, you know, I want to let people know what's going on, you know? But I've seen over the years that if I don't, it's not going to benefit me, you know? And so I'd rather stay here with you guys and just keep doing this, you know? And like I said, life is not, it's not perfect. Like at the beginning of this pandemic, I'm sure a lot of us had issues going on, but like, I wasn't sure if I was going to stay married, you know? I didn't know how that was going to work, you know? And I had to move out and that wasn't easy, but I knew I did that, having contact with my sponsor, letting him know what was going on. You know, it's decisions like that in my life. I don't just go off the cuff and do stuff on my own, you know. And so I had to move out, and, you know, that was tough. I stayed out for like a month and a half or so, but we ended up working things out. And that's another testament to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. On my own, I destroyed that whole thing. I don't come, you know. And it's been a blessing that, you know, I'm back, and things have been fine. Things are good, you know. We're looking at trying to move and move to, you know, Frederick, Maryland. And it's all a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't take any credit for any of it, you know. And I've seen a lot of people pass away. And I had one of my best friends pass away this year. And that was tough. And you know, it just reminds me, you know, my birthday also was December the 1st. So it just, I don't know if it's just because I'm getting older or what, but, you know, I definitely cherish the friendships I have in my life today. And I try to be available, you know, when I can, especially for my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, and for Alcoholics Anonymous in general, because, you know, I try to live every day to the fullest, man. I try to, you know, even though, you know, I get in this truck and I'm driving and some idiot cuts me off and I'm cussing and, you know, but I get reminded here that it's one day at a time. It's one day at a time, and I'm not perfect. I'm gonna make mistakes, but I'm glad that Alcoholics Anonymous is F-up friendly, you know, and I can make mistakes and come back here and people can help me get back on track, you know, and that's what we do here, you know. We look out for each other, you know, and that's what my grand sponsor taught me. And that's what I'll take to my grave. If I didn't do that, I'd be a slap in that man's face, you know? And so I'm forever grateful, and I'm indebted for the rest of my life to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And so I guess I'll end super early, you know, because I'm about ready to fall over up here. Thanks for letting me share.